and face Aeneas in combat. Good God! Are we no-account souls, to litter the plains, a multitude unburied and unmourned, so that Turnus may marry the heir to the throne? Yes, you, if you've anything in you, any of the fighting spirit of your fathers, look at me! Answer my challenge! The impulsive, intransigent Turnus blazed up in rage at this speech. He gave a groan of anger, then passionately broke out. Words! 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 You've always plenty of them, Drances, when war is asking for deeds. Let a council be summoned, and you are the first to appear. But we don't want big talk from an armchair critic like you, just now in this house, while our battlements still keep the foe at arm's length, and the moat is not yet swimming in blood. Go, pounding on with your usual rhetoric, and accuse me of cowardice, Drances, you whose strong right hand has inflicted such wonderful slaughter upon the Trojans, and set up notable trophies all over the battlefield. There's nothing to stop you trying what real courage can do. You needn't go far, I assure you, to find the enemy. They are massed all round our walls. Are we going to meet them? What? No move from you? Is your bellicose spirit permanently confined to a windy tongue and a clean pair of heels? So, I'm to admit myself beaten? You clot! Could anyone really argue I'm beaten after he'd seen the Tiber in spate with Trojan blood, and the whole house of Evander prostrate, root and branch, and his Arcadians stripped of their arms? Bitias and huge Pandarus did not find me a weakling, nor the countless men my conquering arm dispatched to Hades when I was shut up in the enemy's walls with their ramparts around me. Fighting will not save us. You're raving. Keep those morbid forecasts for yourself and Aeneas. Ah, go on creating alarm and despondency everywhere, cracking up the immense strength of a twice-conquered nation and slandering our own army. You'll be telling us next, the Myrmidon generals are all quaking at the Phrygian forces. Diomed and Laricean Achilles, and Orphidus River is scampering back from the Adriatic. Yes, and look how this artist in scheming gives out his in terror of threats from me, thus using fear to sharpen the edge of his calumny. Don't be alarmed. I would never degrade myself by taking a life like yours. You can keep it tucked up in your cowardly breast. Now, sire, I revert to you and the problems you've laid before us. If you have no more faith in the armed forces, if we are really abandoned by all, if to suffer a single reverse means our whole cause is lost and there's no chance of recovery, then let us lay down our arms and helplessly sue for peace. Yet, I would that some gleam of our traditional valour would show itself. I would esteem that man most fortunate in his exertions, and noblest in soul of us all, who, rather than witness so shameful an end, has fallen and died, has bit the dust once for all. But suppose we have resources and manpower still untapped, potential allies left among the peoples of Italy. Suppose, too, that the Trojans have paid for success with heavy losses. They had their dead all right. The same storm blasted both sides. Then why are we fainting in the first lap of the war and disgracing ourselves? Why tremble before the trumpet has blown? Time and man's versatile efforts over the shifting years have often changed things for the better. Fortune's vicissitudes make fools of us often, and then set our feet again upon firm ground. Diomed and his Aetolians will give us no help, you say. Yes, but we have Messapus, and heaven's favourite, Tolumnius, and captains sent by many peoples. Great glory, too, will attend the flower of Latium and the Laurentine fields. Then there's Camilla, from the illustrious Volscian nation, leading her regiment of horse, her squadrons blooming in bronze. But if the Trojans demand to fight with none but me, if such is your will, and otherwise I'm ruinous to our cause, victory has not been such a total stranger to me that I'd refuse any venture which held out such great possibilities. Though he's Achilles' equal, and carries weapons, as he did, made by Vulcan himself, I'll go out and face Aeneas with all my heart. I, Turnus, second in courage to none of our ancestors, solemnly vow my life to you and Latinus, whose son I would be. Aeneas challenges me alone. I welcome it, whether it's heaven's wrath or honor and glory that's in it. I would not let Drances be martyr to one or crowned with the other. So the Italians were hotly debating these controversial issues. Meanwhile, Aeneas moved out of camp and advanced. Through the palace, a messenger hurried, spreading great consternation around him, so that the whole town was seized with panic. He said the Trojans and the Etruscan forces were sweeping down from the Tiber in battle formation, deploying across the plain. At once the populace rose up, their minds in confusion, their feelings shocked, but their temper aroused by strenuous excitement. Wildly they clamour for action. "To arms!" the young men shout, while the senators gloomily weep and mutter. A monstrous din went up now all over the town as men argued and wrangled together. So it is when a flock of birds have alighted upon the treetops in some wood, or the fish-haunted river Padusa resounds with the harsh screaming of swans till its pools are a bedlam. Turnus, seizing the opportunity, cried, "Fellow citizens, talk on, that's right, and tamely sing the praises of peace, though the enemies launched an offensive against us." Without a word more, he whirled away and ran out from the high-vaulted chamber. "Volusus, order the Volscian squadrons to stand to arms and lead forth the Rutuli. Messapus, Coras, and your brother, get your cavalry moving. Deploy them out in the open. Let every approach to the city be blocked and the turrets manned. The rest will be under my orders to counterattack where I tell them." At once, from all over the city, they raced up to line the battlements. Meanwhile, Latinus adjourned the meeting and left, postponing his grand design, depressed and upset by what had just happened. He censured himself severely for not accepting Aeneas of his own free will, or attaching him to the crown through marriage. Now they are digging trenches in front of the gates and bringing up stones and stakes. The hoarse trumpet blares the alarum for bloody battle. Around the walls there is stretched a motley chain of women and boys. The supreme ordeal calls upon everyone. Now, a great throng of mothers about her, the queen is driving uphill to the temple and heights of Pallas Athene. She bears offerings and has beside her the girl, Lavinia, the cause of these terrible evils, sitting with eyes prettily downcast. The mothers pass into the temple, fill it with smoke of incense, and mournfully utter a prayer as they stand at the door of the sanctuary. "O puissant in arms, O regent of war, Tritonian maiden, break with your hand the spear of the Trojan marauder, and lay him prostrate upon our soil, yea, let him fall in the gateway." Turnus, enraged, is eagerly girding himself for battle. Now he has donned the breastplate whose scales of rugged bronze glow like embers, and fastened the gold greaves on his legs. Head still unhelmeted, he has strapped the sword to his side and is running down from the citadel heights, a flash of gold, and exults in anticipation of coming to grips with the enemy. So, when a horse has broken its tether and galloped away from the paddock, free at last, out on the open plains, look how he makes for the meadow where herds of mares are grazing, or else he plunges into some well-known stream, as he loves to, then leaps out, and throwing his muzzle high, so the mane is tossed over neck and shoulders, he whinnies in wild exhilaration. Camilla hastened to meet him, leading the Volscian squadrons. Right at the gate, the princess jumped down from her horse, and the whole contingent, taking their cue from her, dismounted smartly and stood beside their horses. Then did Camilla say, "Turnus, the brave are surely entitled to feel self-confidence. Therefore I dare, and I promise, to engage the mounted brigade of Aeneas and meet the Etruscan cavalry single-handed. Let me be the first to encounter the hazards of war, while you remain with the infantry here and guard the walls of the town." Eyes fixed on the redoubtable Camilla, Turnus answered, "Princess, Italy's proud of you. How can I ever express or prove my gratitude? But I know your spirit's above all thoughts of recompense, so share this task with me. I had got wind, and now my reconnaissance has confirmed it, that Aeneas has actually thrown forward a wave of light-armed horsemen to sweep the plain, while he moves on the town himself over the deserted mountain heights through a pass. I am planning an ambush, to block both ends of the glen with troops, where his route is a sunken road through heavily wooded terrain. You are to meet the Etruscan cavalry and engage them. You will have the gallant Messapus with you, the Latin squadrons, and the troops of Tibertus. Take over command, and thus share the task with me." So saying, he briefed Messapus and the other allied commanders in similar terms for the fight, then moved against the enemy. There is a winding glen, a place cut out for ambush and bloody stratagems. Hill slopes enclose it on either flank, darkening it with dense leafage. To reach it, you pass down a narrow track through a bottleneck, a nasty, confined approach. Overlooking this from above, at the summit on either side are plateau, invisible from beneath. A sound position, whether you wanted to charge down the slopes at the enemy's flanks, or to sit tight on the ridge and roll down boulders upon him. Turnus arrived at this spot by a route he knew well, occupied it, disposed his men in the woods there, a dangerous threat to Aeneas. Meanwhile, in the abodes of heaven above, Diana was speaking to swift-footed Opis, one of the sacred band of nymphs who attended her, and in a despondent tone was saying, "Camilla goes forth to war and its savagery. She's dear to me, girl, beyond all others, and yet our weapons she's girding on cannot save her. Ah, yes, this is no new love, shaking the heart with sweet surprise that I am feeling. Listen. When Metabus left the ancient town of Privernum, expelled by the people, who hated his tyrannous use of power, he smuggled out with him, as he fled through the street fighting, his baby daughter, to be a companion in exile. He named her after her mother, Casmilla, just changing the name to Camilla. Carrying her against his breast, he made for the mountains, a long ridge, wooded and lonely. Pursuers were close behind him, and Volscian soldiers were skimming round to cut off his retreat. All at once, as he fled, there was the Amasenus in front of him, running bank high, in full spate after a recent cloudburst. He is eager to swim for it, but is held back by love and fear for the infant he tenderly carries. Casting about in his mind, of a sudden this desperate remedy dawns on him. Taking the mighty spear he had with him for self-defense, a solid, gnarled, well-seasoned piece of wood, he fastened the baby to its shaft, cocooning her first in bark from a cork tree, and fixed her right at its point of balance for throwing. Then poised the spear in his huge hand, praying aloud to heaven, "O kindly Diana the Virgin, patron of woodlands, I, her father, vow this child to your service. Yours the first weapon she holds to, a suppliant fleeing the foe. I invoke you, O goddess, accept her for yours, whom now I commit to the chancy breezes." So saying, he drew back his arm and sent the spear shaft spinning. The waters roared beneath. Over the racing river the spear went whirring. Upon it hurtled poor little Camilla. But Metabus, since a great pack of pursuers was now drawing closer, dived into the stream and triumphantly plucked from the turf on the far side the spear with his babe still attached, his present to Diana. No city offered him home or shelter. He'd not have accepted it anyway, being averse to civilization. Instead, he lived out his life among shepherds in desolate mountain country. Here, in the thickets, the tangled coverts where wild beasts prowled, he nursed the baby girl on milk drawn from the breast of a broodmare, milking the teats into her delicate mouth. But as soon as the child had found her feet and learnt to walk, Metabus put a pointed javelin in her hand and slung a bow and a quiver across her little shoulder. Instead of a golden clasp for her locks and a trailing robe, a tiger skin hooded her hair and cloaked her from head to foot. Even then, her soft child's hand could hurl miniature weapons. And, whirling the sling around her head by its twisted thong, she could bring down a white swan or a crane from the river Strymon. There were many mothers in the Etruscan cities who vainly sighed for her as a daughter. She was well pleased to serve Diana alone, to remain a virgin forever, worshipping chastity and the chase. Would she had not succumbed to desire for such service as this, or attempted to challenge the Trojans. Then she'd be one of my train still, and I could love and protect her. But come, since a bitter, untimely doom is surely upon her, glide down from the sky, Opis, and visit the land of Latium, where, under no lucky star for her, grim battle is toward. Take my bow and quiver. Draw out an avenging arrow. With it, exact retribution in blood for me from the man who wounds and profanes her hallowed flesh, Italian or Trojan. Then I shall bear away in the womb of a cloud her piteous body, her weapons intact, to a grave in her own country. Diana had spoken. Opis swooped rustling down from above, through the light airs of heaven, wrapped in a dark storm cloud. Meantime, the enemy force approaches the walls of Latium. The whole brigade of cavalry, with its Etruscan officers, moving in squadron formation. Over the plain's expanse the chargers prance and neigh, swerving this way and that as they fight the restraining curb. The field is all iron, one endless bristle of lances. The plains flash with uplifted weapons. Against them move Messapus, the swift-riding Latins, Coras with his brother, and the wing led by the maiden Camilla. These now emerge on the plain and range themselves opposite. Hands drawn well back, they hold the lance in rest or brandish the javelin. Warriors advancing, horses neighing, the moment kindles. And now each side had moved forward into spear range, and there halted. Then, with a sudden yell, they all charged, spurring their maddened horses, and hurled as they charged volleys of weapons which stormed as thick as a blizzard, darkening the very sky. Tyrrhenus and gallant Aconteus rode each at the other incontinent, lances in rest, were the first to meet, to crash with a noise like thunder and fall. Their horses collided head-on, so that breast was broken and shattered on breast. The impact unseated Aconteus, and hurled him afar, like a meteorite or a great stone fired from a catapult. He died before he hit the ground. At once the formations were thrown into disorder. The Latins wheeled round and galloped towards the walls, with their shields behind them. The Trojans pursued hotly, Asilas leading their squadrons. Then, as they neared the gates, the Latins raised the war cry again, and pulled at the sinuous necks of their horses to turn them. So now the Trojans went back a long way in flight, with loose reins. It was like the to-fro rhythm of the sea, when a wave runs forward, comes charging against the shore, rides over the rocks in a smother of spray, and drenches the sand far up on the beach where the swell breaks. Then rapidly draws away, the force of its undertow sucking the pebbles back, swirls out, grows shallow, is gone from the shore. Twice the Etruscans drove to the walls the fleeing Rutuli, twice galloped back, looking over their shoulders, with shields held behind for protection. But when the opposing forces clashed for a third time, the lines were locked together, and each man marked his man. Then the groans of the dying were heard. It was all a welter of blood, a tangle of weapons and bodies, with mortally wounded horses plunging amid dead riders. Bitterly swelled the struggle. Orsilochus dared not meet Remulus hand to hand, but threw a spear at his charger, which lodged under its ear. Driven mad by the blow, the unendurable pain of this wound, the horse reared up its great chest, its forelegs thrashing the air, and Remulus was hurled to the ground. Catillus struck down Iolas and Herminius, a man of great courage, a giant in shoulder and trunk, whose auburn hair was unhelmeted and his shoulders bare. He had no terror of wounds, so much of himself he exposed to the enemy. Driven through his broad shoulders, the spear stuck quivering and doubled him up with agony. Everywhere streams the dark blood. They struggle. They deal out doom with the sword and offer themselves to a glorious death in the combat. Right in the thick of the slaughter, with one breast bared for the fray like an Amazon, was exulting the archeress Camilla. Now she delivers a quick fire of whippy javelins. Now, unwearied, she whirls a powerful battle-axe with her right hand. Tapping her shoulder hung the gold bow, Diana's weapon. Even when she was driven back and in flight, she loosed her shafts at the foe as she fled, turning the bow round to shoot them. Her bodyguard kept close about her, the maiden Larina, Tulla, Tarpeia, who brandished a battle-axe of bronze, Italian girls, whom the godlike Camilla had chosen to grace her retinue. Good supporters they were, in peace and in war. They resembled the Amazon women of Thrace when they go to battle in blazoned armor, their horse hooves stamping the frozen river Thermodon, escorting Queen Hippolyta or the martial Penthesilea when she returns from a war in her chariot. A woman host with crescent-shaped bucklers screaming around her in triumph. Ferocious Camilla, whom first did your hand lay low? Whom last? How many men did you strike to the earth, dying? Eunias was the first, Clytius' son. Her long pinewood spear crashed through his unguarded chest as he faced her. Coughing up streams of blood, Eunias fell. He bit the ensanguined earth, and dying, he spun round on his wound. Next she killed Lyris and Pagasus over him. One had been thrown when his horse was stabbed in the belly and was gathering up the reins. The other was stretching his free hand to help the dazed man to his feet. Side by side they fell headlong. Camilla killed too Amastrus, Hippotas' son, and flung spears with a long follow-through from a distance at Tereus and Harpalicus, Demophoon and Chromis. For every single missile the princess aimed and threw, a Phrygian warrior fell. Far off, queerly accoutred, was riding the hunter, Ornytus, upon his Apulian steed. He wore for battle the hide of a bullock swathed about his broad shoulders, while his head was helmeted in a wolf's mask, whose gaping mouth with its white-fanged jaws served for a visor. A rustic hunting spear was his weapon. Ornytus turned, with horsemen everywhere round him, overtopping all by a head. She caught him. No difficult task in the jam of a routed formation. Pierced him, and over his body spoke these unmerciful words. Did you think you were hunting game in your own forest, Etruscan? The day has come when a woman's weapons shall hurl your people's boasting back in their teeth. Never mind. You will go to the shades of your fathers with one piece of glory. You fell by the hand of Camilla. Next she killed Orsilochus and Butes, two great champions of Troy. Butes she hit with a spear while he was turned away, just where the rider's neck showed between helmet and breastplate, where the shield hangs down from the left shoulder. Orsilochus she fled from, riding in a wide circle, then, tightening her circle, tricked him. Herself became the pursuer. Now, standing up in the stirrups, she hacked her strong axe through his armor and bones, though he begged and prayed for mercy, sending in blow upon blow. Warm brains from his cloven skull spattered his face. A warrior, the son of Aunus, an Apennine farmer, now happened her way, stood rooted to earth by shock and panic at seeing her. Not least of Ligurian tricksters he, while fate allowed him to cheat. When he saw it was too late now to avoid an encounter, or to divert Camilla's onset by running away, he tried to take her in with guileful, provocative words, beginning thus, "You're a woman, but must you rely on a strong steed to win your distinction? Get rid of that chance to escape, and meet me fair and square on the ground, if you dare. Yes, fight me on foot. You'll soon find out who is bluffing and boasting, and who'll be undone by it." Stung by these words to bitter resentment, Camilla, in high rage, gave up her horse to a comrade and fearlessly faced him on foot with no advantage in weapons, drawn sword and unblazoned shield. The Ligurian, however, believing he'd gained his ends by this ruse, promptly wheeled round his horse and started away, the coward, in flight, plying the fleet-footed steed with his iron spurs. "Deluded fool, you have overreached yourself with your own conceit. You think you're a smart boy, but all the smooth tricks you have learnt from your folk won't get you back to your crooked father or save you." So saying, Camilla ran, swift as a bushfire, after him, headed him off, stood full in his horse's path. Then, seizing its reins, she took her revenge deep in the blood of her enemy. With the same ease will a falcon, prophetic bird, take off from a crag to pursue the dove which is flying high overhead, will catch it, seize it, slash out its bowels with hooked talons, so blood and a scatter of feathers come floating down from the sky. But the father of gods and men, aloft on the heights of Olympus, did not observe these events with an indifferent eye. He inspired the Etruscan Tarchon to fight with greater ferocity, spurred him roughly on, whetted the edge of his anger. So Tarchon rode amongst the wavering formations, the slaughter, goading his squadrons with shouts of abuse and encouragement, calling each man by name, and rallied his broken forces. "Can nothing shame you, Etruscans? Will you never snap out of your lethargy? What are you scared of? Why this shocking display of cowardice? So, now a woman can send you flying and rout our proud ranks. What are your swords meant for? Why carry arms and not use them? You're vigorous enough where girls are concerned and tussles in bed. Or when a dance is on and the curved flute of Bacchus invites you? Well, keep your strength for the banquet, the groaning table, the wine cups, if guzzling is all you care for. And wait till the priest has announced good omens, and you can picnic off the rich meat of the sacrifice." So saying, he spurred his charger into the fray, as ready to risk his own life as his men's lives, and swept like a cyclone on Venulus. Tearing him off his horse, Tarchon furiously galloped away, with his right arm clamping the man to the saddle in front of him. All the Latins turned their eyes on the spectacle. Shouts went up to the sky. Now Tarkon streaks over the plain like wildfire, carrying the man and his weapons. He breaks off the business end of his enemy's spear, and with it probes for a joint in his armor, through which he can give him the death blow. But Venulus fights back to hold off Tarkon's hand from his throat, pitting strength against violence. It was like when a golden eagle soars aloft with a snake in its grip, twined round its feet, held fast by the claws that impale it. But the snake, though wounded, writhes about with its whip-like coils, and its scales stand up on end, and it hisses in fury, rearing its head to strike. While, fiercely as ever, the bird's hooked beak darts at the lashing snake, and its pinions thrash the air. Just so did Tarkon triumphantly bear off his prey from the ranks of Tibertines. Fired by their general's success, the Etruscans followed his lead and charged. Now, Aruns, that fateful and fated man, circled round the fast-riding Camilla, javelin in hand, cleverly anticipating her movements, seeking the best way to strike. Wherever the berserk princess rode in the thick of the melee, there Aruns would appear, shadowing her unobtrusively. When she withdrew from some successful foray at the foe, this warrior stealthily wheeled his swift horse and kept contact with her. Hefting his sure-as-doom spear, nothing would foil him, he tried for one opening after another, circling and circling about her. It befell that Chloreus, a one-time priest in the service of Cybele, showed at a distance the shining Phrygian armor conspicuous, spurring his foam-flecked mount, which wore a horse-cloth, a hide armored with scales of bronze, like plumage, and buckled with gold. Chloreus himself, resplendent in dusky, exotic purple, was shooting Cretan arrows from a bow of Lycian make. Golden the bow this warrior carried, and gold the helmet he wore. His mantle was made of linen, a saffron color, and a red-gold brooch held fastened its rustling folds. His tunic and oriental trews were embroidered with golden thread. Whether she wished to hang up his Trojan arms in a temple, or to strip off his gold and wear it herself, Camilla picked out this man from the mass of combatants there, and trailed him, blind to all else, in full cry, recklessly ranging amid the battle, on fire with a woman's desire for another's finery. Now had come Aaron's chance at last. From where he was lurking, he lifted his spear, poised it, prayed to the heavens above. Most worshipful god, Apollo, guardian of blessed Soracte, where we, your chief devotees, heap up in your honour the blazing pine logs, and walk through the midst of the flames, sure in our faith, treading the high-piled embers as we perform your rites. Apollo, puissant in battle, grant that I may rub out this stain on our escutcheon. I ask no spoils, no trophy of her defeat. It is not loot that I want. I'll be famous for other deeds. Let me but strike down this pestilent fury, and I will gladly return home, taking no credit for it. Apollo silently gave his assent to one part of Aaron's prayer, but the rest he tore up and threw to the four winds. He granted his wish to take Camilla off guard and deal her a mortal wound, but that ever he should return to his own land, he granted not. Those words were snatched away on the breezes. So, when the spear of Aruns went whistling from his hand, the Volscians turned their fiercely expectant minds and eyes all upon the Queen Camilla. She was oblivious. No wind, no sound of the hurtling weapon she got. Next moment the spear went into her body, just under the naked breast, and stuck there, deeply drinking the maiden blood where it lodged. In consternation, her friends rushed up and caught their queen as she collapsed. Most frightened of all was Aruns. In fear, mingled with exultation, he fled. He would not trust his weapon, or dare to face Camilla's a moment longer. Just as, before the armed pursuers can get on his trail, some cowardly wolf, which has killed a shepherd or a big steer, makes rapidly off, avoiding the beaten paths, to hide in the mountains, and, knowing quite well he has done wrong, he runs to the wooded heights, with his quivering tail between his legs, even so did Aaron's remove himself from their view, all wrought up, and vanished into the ruck of the fighters, glad just to escape. Camilla, dying, tugged at the spear, but its iron blade, deep in her body, was firmly fastened between the ribs there. She is sinking, faint from loss of blood. Her fainting eyes are glazed with the frost of death. The colour ebbs from her face. Now, with her last breath, she spoke to Acca, a girl of her own age, one who had been her confidant, and of all her companions was the truest. These were the words she spoke. "Acca, dear, I can do no more. This bitter wound is the end of me. Shadows are falling. It's growing dark all round me. Make your best speed, and bring this last message of mine to Turnus. He must take my place here and fight the Trojans off from the city. Now, goodbye." So saying, she loosed her grip on the reins and helplessly slid to the ground. Then, little by little, her body grew numb and released its hold upon life. Her neck was drooping, her head bowed down to victorious death. She let go of her weapons, and with a moan her protesting spirit fled to the shades. Then, oh, then, a terrific outcry arose. The welkin rang, and the fight grew fiercer because of Camilla's death. All the Teucrian force, the Etruscan captains, Evander's Arcadian squadrons, all of them launched a concerted attack. But Opis, Diana's observer, had long been watching the fight, unflinching, from where she sat on a high mountain top. Now, when she beheld from afar Camilla, right there in the yelling melee of warriors, struck down and dying a piteous death, Opis heavily sighed and spoke with deepest emotion. "Ah, cruel, too bitterly cruel, poor lass, the forfeit you've paid for having dared to challenge the Teucrian host in battle. You lived alone in the wild wood. You served Diana and carried our quiver upon your shoulder. But none of this saved you now. Still, your mistress has seen that you shall not be left dishonored in death's last hour. Your dying shall be a famous thing among the nations. They shall not say you were unavenged. Whoever it was that wounded and desecrated your body shall get the death he deserves." Under that mountain height there was a huge barrow, the tomb of an old Laurentine king, Decenus, lying beneath the shade of holm oaks. First, then, the beautiful nymph, with a movement swift as light, came and stood here, from the top of the mound, looking out for Aruns. When she saw him, shining in armour and swelling with idle vanity, she said, "Why are you moving away? Come over here. Come deathwards. Come and receive the reward you deserve for killing Camilla. Yes, you're a wretch, but you'll die by Diana's weapons." So saying, the Thracian nymph took from her quiver of gold a flighted arrow and stretched her bow, aiming at Aruns. She drew the string right back, till the ends of the curving bow had almost met, her hands level, the left supporting the arrow's point, the right hand drawing the string to her nipple. Next moment, Aruns heard the whiz of a shaft, the whirring it made through the air, and the arrow pierced him that very same instant. His comrades, unconcerned, left him, gasping and moaning, with his last breath on the dust of the plain. An inglorious end. While Opis winged her way back to the heights of Olympus. Their mistress fallen, Camilla's light brigade were the first to fly. Then the Rutulians and gallant Atinas broke in panic. Detachments left leaderless, officers who had lost touch with their troops, now wheeled away and raced back to the cover of the walls. There was no holding the Trojans' deadly, remorseless pressure. However hard you fought, no standing against them. The Latins, slinging their unstrung bows on weary shoulders, retired, and as they galloped away, the hammering hooves shook the dry flats. A dust cloud, dark and whirling, rolls up to the city walls, where mothers stand in the watchtowers, and as they gaze forth, beat their breasts. The shrieks of women go up to the heavens above. Those who first poured in through the open gates at a gallop had a crowd of the enemy hard on their heels, even riding amongst them, and did not escape a cruel death. At the actual gateways, within the walls, and worse, in the houses where they took refuge, they were speared and breathed their last. Some of them shut the gates, barring their comrades out, and for all their appeals dared not admit them to the city. A tragic slaughter ensued between those defending the gates and their own friends fighting to enter. Of those shut out, in full view of their weeping parents, one lot were tumbled into the moat by the pressure of those in panic behind them, while others, with loose rein, were blindly riding full tilt into the solid doors that stood in their way, and ramming them. The mothers themselves, on the battlements, they had seen Camilla's example, and genuine love of their country showed them the way, with the utmost energy hastened to hurl down missiles, impulsively making tough poles of oak and fire-hardened stakes to do the work of cold steel. Eager they were to be first to die in defense of the city. Meantime, desperate tidings came to the ears of Turnus while he lay in the woods, for Acca brought word of the grave disaster, how the Volscian forces had been wiped out and Camilla had fallen, how the foe were attacking fiercely, the battle had gone their way and they'd swept all before them. Panic now lapped at the town walls. Turnus, in anger, for so the stern will of Jove required, moved off from his menacing ambush among the trees on the hillside. He had scarcely marched out of sight of that place and reached the plain below when Aeneas entered the pass, now unobstructed, surmounted the ridge and debouched from the dark woods with his army. So both of them, leading their columns, were rapidly marching towards the city, with no great interval between them. At one and the same moment, Aeneas descried at a distance ahead the plain smoking with dust, the Laurentine forces moving across it, and Turnus became aware of the armed array of relentless Aeneas, heard the tramp of feet and the snorting of chargers. They would have joined battle and fought it out immediately, but that the roseate sun now dipped his weary steeds in the Iberian Sea, and day was darkening to night. So both of them, camping outside the city, consolidate their positions. Book 12. When Turnus saw that the Latins were crushed by defeat and in lowest spirits, saw too that all eyes were upon him as if demanding that now he should make good his promise, he burned with a mood all the more uncompromising. His temper sharpened. Just as an African lion, when he's received a bad wound in the breast from the hunters, then at last becomes really dangerous, gleefully tosses the shaggy mane from his neck, and uncowed snaps at the assailant's arrow stuck in him, breaks it, roars with his mouth all bloody. So Turnus looks. His violent intransigence kindles and mounts up. Now, with an outburst of passion, he speaks to Latinus, saying, "I am not holding back. Those yellow Trojans have no cause to swallow their words or renounce their agreement, as far as I am concerned. I shall fight him. Make ready the rights and frame the terms. Either this hand of mine will send that Dardan, that runaway Asiatic, to hell. The Latins may sit and look on at us, and with my sword I'll wipe out the slur on our people's good name. Or he'll have Lavinia in marriage, and the rest of you in subjection. Latinus would not be rushed off his feet. He replied equably, Prince, I admire your spirit. But the higher your passionate courage rises, the deeper and more attentively I must ponder what's best. I have to be cautious and weigh all sides of the question. You own the realm of your father, Daunus, and many cities you've captured in war, while I have gold and am not close-fisted. Are there not other unmarried girls of good birth in Latium and the Laurentine land? To speak with brutal frankness and lay all my cards on the table, please take to heart what I'm saying. I never had the right to promise my daughter to any of her old suitors. Both oracles and popular feeling forbade it. But, overborne by my affection for you, by our kinship and the tears of my grieving wife, I disregarded all vetoes. I cheated Aeneas of his bride, and took up arms in a bad cause. What a disastrous war has resulted from this, you can see. And how great are the evils, Turnus, which you are the first to suffer. Twice beaten in full-scale battles, we can hardly hold this town now, Italy's last hope. The Tiber is still running warm with our blood, and our people's bones are blanching the plain all over. My mind yaws like a madman's, forever washed back to the same point. If I'm prepared to make friends with the Trojans on Turnus' death, why don't I end the conflict while he is still alive? Think what your Rutulian kinsmen, what all Italy would say, if I were responsible for Turnus getting killed, God save the mark, through his desire to marry my daughter. Reflect how war can change men's fortunes. Be sympathetic towards your old father, who grieves for you, cut off as he is in his native Ardea. These words made no impression at all upon Turnus' intransigence. Nay, it increased. The cure only inflamed it. As soon as he was able to speak, he began like this. The anxiety you show for me, most gracious king, I implore you for my sake to discard. Let me purchase fame with death. I am no weakling, sire. I too can rain blows and deliver fusillades. Men bleed when I wound them, same as Aeneas. His goddess mother will not be on hand, concealed in mere shadow, to cover his flight with a cloud, delusive as woman herself. But the queen, greatly alarmed by this new turn of the struggle, clung to the hot-headed Turnus, weeping, knowing her death near. By these tears of mine, by whatever love and respect you feel for me, I implore you, Turnus, since you are my one hope now, sole stay of my sad old age, since Latinus' honour, authority, rest in your charge. But for you we should collapse altogether. One thing I beg, give up this idea of fighting the Trojan. Whatever hazards await you in such a duel, the same await me too. If you die, then will I quit a life I hate. Aeneas shall not be my son, nor I his captive. Lavinia listened while her mother was speaking. Tears flowed down her burning cheeks, suffused with a deep crimson blush that spread all over the glowing face. Imagine a piece of Indian ivory stained with a blood-red dye by a craftsman, or a bouquet of white lilies blended with many red roses. That was how the hues in the girl's face looked. Turnus, deeply moved by love, gazed hard at Lavinia. More eager than ever to fight, he spoke to the queen briefly. Please do not send me forth to the tough encounter before me, with tears and with such defeatist, ominous words, Amata. If I'm to die, it's not in my power to postpone the hour of it. Idmon, act as my herald and take this word to the Phrygian despot. It won't amuse him. As soon as tomorrow's dawn rides up the sky in its rosy car and flushes it, let him not lead the Teucrians against us. Let there be armistice for Trojans and Rutuli, while he and I settle the war between us. That fight shall decide who is to have Lavinia. When he had finished speaking, he quickly withdrew to his own place and called for his horses, happy to see them neighing before him. Those steeds, more dazzling white than snow, swifter than winds, which Orithya herself had graciously given to Pilumnus. The charioteers stand busily round them, slapping their resonant barrels with open hand, and comb the luxurious manes. Turnus then put over his shoulders a corselet stiff with gold and pale orichalc, at the same time fitting on ready his sword, his shield, and the helmet with sockets to hold its red crest. The sword had been made for Daunus, his father, by the Fire Lord's own hands, who had tempered the white-hot blade in the waters of Styx. Now he snatched quickly up his powerful spear, which was leaning against a mighty column in the central courtyard. He'd won it as spoil from the Auruncan Actor, and shouted aloud as he shook the vibrating shaft. "Ah! Now is your chance, my spear. You have never failed me when I have called on you. Actor, a great champion, carried you once. Now Turnus hefts you. Together we'll bring that Phrygian pansy down, tear open and rend off his corselet by main force. We'll dabble in the dust those lovelocks he crisps and dolls up with curling tongs and smarms with perfumed grease." He was wildly wrought up, so burning for battle that all his countenance seemed to shoot sparks and darts of fire to come from his fierce eyes. So it is when a bull bellows out its first terrible challenge to combat and practices throwing all its fury into its horns by goring trunks of trees, butts at the air in anger, paws and tosses the sand as a prelude of coming battle. Aeneas, the while, a grim figure in the arms his mother had brought him, was whetting no less his desire for the fight, and keying himself up with anger, glad of the chance to settle the war on these terms. Now he comforts his friends, and the dreadfully anxious Ascanius, with things the fates have told him, bids officers to take to Latinus a definite answer, and to dictate the conditions of peace. The morrow's dawn was just beginning to shower its light on the mountain tops, and out of the deep sea the sun's horses were starting to climb and breathing the day from uplifted nostrils, when Trojans and Rutuli paced out on the plain, beneath the great town walls, the lists for the combat, and made them ready, setting up braziers and altars of turf to the gods they both worshipped in the middle of the arena. Some, wearing the priestly aprons and garlanded with field herbs, were bringing fire and spring water. Now the Italian army moved off, surged out through the gates, marching in close column. From the other side, the Etruscan and Trojan forces streamed on, with their diverse equipment, heavily armed and in formation, as if for the stern arbitrament of battle. Amongst the assembled thousands, the captains move about, haughty in gold and purple. Nestius of the Assaracan line, valiant Asilas, Messapus too, the tamer of horses, the scion of Neptune. When the signal is given, each side retires to the area allotted it. Planting their spears in the ground, they lean their shields up against them. Then the women came running out excitedly, with the unarmed civilians and frail old men, to throng the towers and the roofs of the houses, while other spectators stood by the tall gateways. But Juno, Looking forth from the eminence which today we call the Alban Hill, then it had neither name nor fame, was attentively gazing at the Laurentine ranks, and the Trojan arrayed upon the plain, and Latinus' city. At once she addressed Juturna, the sister of Turnus, deity speaking to deity, she being goddess of lakes and sounding rivers. For Jove himself, the king of high heaven, had conferred this office on her in return for the maidenhead he had ravished. Water spirit, most dear to my heart, pride of the rivers, you know that of all the Italian maids who have mounted into the unrewarding bed of large-hearted Jove, I have singled you out and gladly promoted you to a place in heaven. I must tell you what pain is in store for you, lest you blame me for causing it. As far as fortune seemed to allow, and the fate spinners granted that Latium's affairs should go well, I have shielded your walls and your brother. But now I see he is facing a destiny loaded against him. The day of doom is here. The enemy's hand is upon him. I cannot endure to look on at this duel, or its preliminaries. If you dare do anything more effective to aid your brother, do it. You may. You and he may yet have a chance, poor souls. She had hardly finished speaking when Juturna burst into tears and violently struck her beautiful breast 3 times and again. Saturnian Juno cried, "This is no time for weeping. Hurry, and if there's a way, rescue your brother from death, or start them all fighting. Arrange that this embryo peace be stillborn. I am behind you, whatever you venture." With such encouragement, Juno left her, bemused, unsettled, in agony of mind. Meantime, the kings came forth, Latinus, heroic of stature, riding a 4-horse chariot, his temples crowned and brilliant with coronet of 12 gold rays, an emblem of his ancestor, the sun, while Turnus rode behind a white pair, swinging a couple of broad-bladed javelins. Over there, Lord Aeneas, father of the Roman nation, bright in the armour from heaven, his shield like a star flashing, moves out of camp, with Ascanius beside him, the other hope for Rome's great future. A priest, clothed in immaculate vestments, has led up the young of a bristly boar, and with it an unshorn 2-year-old sheep, and brought the beasts to the flaming altars. The heroes, turning their eyes towards the rising sun, sprinkle the salted meal from their hands, cut off with a knife the victim's forelocks, and pour libations from bowls on the altars. Then did Aeneas the true, drawing his sword, pray, "Let the sun witness my invocation now, and this earth, for whose sake I have endured to go through such terrible travails, and you, Father Almighty, and you, Saturnian Juno, kindlier disposed to me now, I hope and pray, and you, famed Mars, whose providence governs and shapes all wars, and I call upon springs and rivers, on all the dread powers of the sky above us, and every deity haunting the cobalt sea, if so it be that the victory goes to Italian Turnus, it's agreed that the vanquished side shall withdraw to Evander's city. Ascanius shall quit this soil, and my people shall never renew the war thereafter, or challenge Latium with the sword. But if victory falls to me in this fight, as I deem more likely, and may the assent of the gods confirm me in so believing, I shall not make the Italians a subject race to the Trojans, nor do I seek this realm for my own. Let both our peoples, unconquered, as equal partners, be joined in a league forever. The gods and the hallows I'll give. Latinus shall keep, as my father, his arms and his rightful authority. The Trojans shall build for me my city walls, and Lavinia shall give her name to the city." Aeneas spoke first like that. Then did Latinus follow, gazing up at the heavens, stretching his right hand towards them. "I too, Aeneas, Swear by earth, by sea, by sky, by Apollo and Diana, by Janus facing both ways, by the power of the underworld gods and the shrine of Dis, the merciless. May the Father, whose lightning sanctions our treaties, hear me. I touch the altar. I call on the fire and the Godhead between us. Never, for us Italians,